Olá, Andrés.
Olá, Anand. Bom dia.
Ah, bom dia, buenos dias. Very nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Anand.
So today my guest is Andrés Medaglia. He's full professor of industrial engineering at Universidad de los Andes in Bogotá, Colombia, and director of the Centro para la Optimización y Probabilidad Aplicada, COPPA. He has more than 20 years of experience designing, developing, and applying optimization methodologies to transportation and logistics, healthy and sustainable cities, engineering design, and agricultural systems. His research has led to over 70 peer-reviewed publications in OR. He currently serves in the editorial boards of Transportation Science, CNOR, the European Journal of Industrial Engineering, and TOP. He has served as Secretary and Vice President of ALIO, as Vice President of Central South America for the Institute of Industrial and Systems Engineers, and as Vice President of the Colombian OR Society. In INFORMS, he currently serves in the Publications Committee. He has been the recipient of several awards, most recently the Glover Klingman Prize, the INFORMS TSL President Service Award, the iFIRST Prize for OR in Development, and the Euro Award for the Best eJOR Review Paper. As an avid amateur cyclist, he has won bronze, silver, and gold medals in the Colombian Individual Time Trial Championships at the Masters category. Andres, you are one of the most important OR scholars here in Latin America, and it's a great honor to have you here. Muchas gracias. ¿Cómo estás? How are you?
Thank you, Anand, and thank you very much for the invitation and that kind introduction. The pleasure is mine being hosted by you.
Ah, nice. So before we start, I would like you to see that I'm wearing the jersey of the Colombian national soccer team that I bought when I visited you in Bogota in 2017. I visited you and David Alvarez Martinez at the Universidad de los Andes, UniAndes. I went there with my very good friend Luis Miguel Escobar Falcón. I actually met him when I first went to Colombia in 2012. I was invited by Ramon Alfonso Gallego Rendon and Eliana Toro to visit La UTP, which is the Universidad Tecnológica de Pereira. I also collaborated with a public transportation company a few years ago called Integra from Pereira in Colombia. So this is just to say that I have a very strong connection with the country.
Well, definitely you have, Anand, and I remember very well your visit, and now I believe you are a true fan of soccer and Colombian soccer. That's amazing. Being also close to Brazil, so it's amazing that you wear our jersey.
Yeah.
I have a lot of pride.
Yeah, I had a very nice time at UniAndes. You guys are super good hosts. It was also nice to meet the young and enthusiastic students at that time. So it was a huge pleasure to visit you there. So Andres, I know they refer to you as Medaglia in Colombia, but do you prefer Medaglia itself or Medaglia, like in Italian?
Anand, it's just I normally pronounce it as it sounds in Spanish, so I go for Medaglia, but either way is fine.
So, are you from Bogota or someplace else in Colombia?
Anand, I'm from Bogota, the capital city, so this is up in the mountains, 2600 meters above the sea level. So yeah, this is where I grew up and now I live.
Do you come from a middle-class family? What did your parents do for a living?
Anand, definitely I come from a middle class family. My father worked in insurance companies, and actually he worked always for the same insurance company as it was normal before. So he worked there, and my mother was a housewife. Later on, when he passed away in a traffic accident, she stepped up. She had to reinvent herself, became an entrepreneur, and I was supported by her and my sister as well.
So how old were you when your father had the accident?
I was 12. I was 12. So it was early in my childhood. That's why I admire my mother a lot, and she was very key for me. She had, as I said, reinvent herself, and she pulled us through the best education that we had. And I think that was amazing. Mm-hmm. So I owe her a lot. Mm-hmm.
So you quickly became the man of the family.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah.
So you grew up during the 70s and 80s. I know the 80s were an intense period in Colombia. But what are your memories from these two decades?
You know, I have to think, but whenever I go back in my memories, and I feel that I have been very a very happy person. And even when I was growing up in the 70s, I used to have a lot of fun just playing with my friends in my neighborhood, in high school, riding my bike in the streets. So it was a very happy childhood, I would say. And making this parallel with this difficult time that we were facing in the 70s, it was pretty much okay, because we did have some the initial, you know, cartels, but they were more interested probably in marijuana, so it was not as hard as in the 80s when they switched to cocaine. And that's the time when then I was in high school by that time, and then things started to get a little bit harder in terms of these drug cartels were infiltrating every layer of the society, and they were trying to get into the Congress and getting more political power and so on, and having their own agenda. So at that time, we started in the 80s, we started to have more of a war against, you know, the establishment, the government, and the cartel. So at that time, of course, we kept our lives, you know, going, because you know how this is part of our culture as well. We are very resilient, but you know, there was this big conflict with the drug cartels. Mm-hmm. And that was a really uncertain time, I would say. So sometimes you were just like facing this fact that you were going out from your house, say living in the morning, and you were uncertain if you were going to return, or even your parents, because there were these random bombings where, you know, the drug traffickers were putting, or the drug cartels were putting a lot of pressure to the government to change their tactics against them, which was mainly the extradition treaty. The drug cartels, they were really, they fear a lot this extradition to being judged in the United States. So that was the part when things got probably messier, because they were changing, they were trying to pressure the civilians to avoid these random bombings. So that was a very uncertain time, and it was, you know, a lot of judges, presidential candidates, and prominent people, journalists, they were being killed by them. So it was a really difficult time, mm-hmm. when I remember.
Yeah.
Late 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did any of your friends or close ones die during that period?
Definitely. It was very common, because as I said, they were just aiming civilians. So you were just in the major streets in Bogota, they were putting these bombs in Cali, in Medellin. So it was really bad. They were all also killing police just by paying them, you know, some money just to kill police. So to have this fear in the society. So of course, some friends died, or relatives. And so it was hard. But it was not just me. It was so many people affected by this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also kidnappings. Kidnappings was part of the folklore in that mm-hmm. time, which was really bad.
So you're like going from point A to point B, but there are a lot of uncertainties during the way.
Totally, Anand. And so basically, you know, for us, and probably it's now part of our own way of dealing with things, we got accustomed to call back at home telling, okay, I reach point B and I'm safe. And you were expecting the same from your parents or your friends. Like whenever you were moving in the city, you were reporting, okay, I'm fine, everything's fine. It was sort of that. Mm-hmm. So it was like a war, like living in war. But mm-hmm. you know, and this is something that it's strange to realize. But even though you have this terrible thing happening in your daily life, then you have these many good things happening as well. You were trying to make the best out of your life, so mm-hmm. you were still enjoying life as normal as you could.
Yeah. Even as a kid, I was aware of the Colombian drug cartels because they were all over the news. I even learned the name of some Colombian cities like Medellin, Cali because of that. Pablo Escobar was a celebrity. On the other hand, I have very good memories of the Colombian soccer national team of the early 90s. Let's talk about good things, right? I like some of the flamboyant players like Higuita and Valderrama with all their hairs. and also other good players like Rincón, Aristizábal, Asprilla, Valencia, and so on. So yeah, these are my first memories of Colombia.
Well, you just mentioned a wonderful team that we had in the 90s, as you said, and you know, at that time, people were so excited when we beat Argentina, for your pleasure.
5-0.
5-0 in Buenos Aires. So people thought that we were having the next world champion. It was not like that. As you know, we had this catastrophe in the US World Cup, in the World Cup in the US, and then we were just out in the first round. But you know, and that's pretty much Colombia, Anand. It's a lot of passion. You have this peak of talent, and then you get probably down into the worst point when you have this noise. No, you have a lot of passion, but then it's difficult for a coach to handle all this talent, but all personalities, and trying to get the best out of this team. So that's pretty much Colombia. You know, you have a lot of passion, a lot of talent, but then mm-hmm. you have some noise, yes. uncertainty, and noise in the culture. Yeah, but yeah. You know, that makes things challenging, but nice.
Yeah, I was rooting for Colombia in that World Cup because, you know, I liked the team very much. But as you said, they did not perform well, and they were out in the first phase. And sadly, Escobar, the defense player, got killed. because of, I'm not sure whether if it was the own goal that he did in one match, but that was also one thing that I was really shocked to learn about.
And that's the part that it's so difficult to understand sometimes about Colombia, because as you said, you know, we have this peak of joy that it was the World Cup and having this wonderful team, and 1 month after in a short period after they returned to the country, this defense player, who, as you said, scored an own goal, he was shot, and apparently it was some drug dealers making some bets and having some fight with him in a public space. Mm-hmm. It was terrible. It was part of the culture at that time. So it's. Imagine that's an anecdote, but it tells you a bit of how was the time that time. It was very turbulent. Mm-hmm. So I'm really happy, and seriously, I appreciate, and this is something that I try to convey to younger generations, is that in that time I had, and many people had the feeling that our country was not viable, that there was no way out, because you know, the drug cartels were so powerful, making a lot of money, infiltrating every layer in society, doing those kind of things, and then we said, okay, probably there is no way out. And I appreciate that some, even the president by that time, had to make some arrangements with them to try to to get the country back on track again. Mm-hmm. So it's hard sometimes. Probably there are many mistakes made by them, but you know, at the end, I'm appreciative that we recovered the country, and at this point, when I see and I reflect, we have a better country now.
Yeah.
Even though we had and we still have many problems.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Colombia has been under right-wing governments for its entire history. Do you think things are going to change now that a left-wing candidate won the election, which was very tight, by the way?
Yeah, and I think that's what I can say now. It's like there is a big hope in terms of the things that could happen in the future, because we do have a lot of social inequalities, and we have a lot of demands in regions. As I said, like I was born in Bogota. Bogota is in the mountains, and you mentioned Pereira. And Pereira is also in the mountains.
Cafetero,
and
Medellin, region.
The coffee region, the wonderful coffee region. So most of the people in the country, they live in cities and in these urban settings. But there is another Colombia that is the most of the territory who have been abandoned for many years because of different conflicts, you know, this conflict against the left wing rebels, then the right-wing paramilitaries infiltrated by the drug money, or either side was infiltrated by them, by drug money. So it was fueled this country, this conflict for decades. So that forced a lot of people from these regions to abandon, to get displaced. And that's pretty sad, you know. So of course now we have like this idea that the focus is going to get back into these regions and have some investment and invest in agriculture and many positive things are being expected from this government, and probably a change in focus. Mm-hmm. With that said, of course, things are not easy because, as you know, in our region, in Latin America, the track record of the left governments are also have some aspects of populism. Mm-hmm. And you need to have a stable economy. I think we are better, as I said, you know, we have been evolving, and this new government is also an evolution of things that have happened in past governments. Like at some point in time, there was not even possible for civilians to go and travel within the country because you were probably getting random kidnapping. It was something like that, mm-hmm. even from one side or the other. So it was a difficult time. So it was natural that some governments, earlier governments, had to get like a more professional armed forces and make the rebels negotiate, and then we got the peace treaty, which was excellent in 2016, and now there is a time of okay, let's do some social investment, and I think there is this hope, but of course there is also fear that populism could affect like the economy, and I hope that's not the case, and most of the people hope that mm-hmm. as well. So yeah. it basically, there is hope, but also some fear that things could go, you know, off tracks in terms of the economy. But at the moment, I think everything is just hope.
Yeah, I completely understand. And that is Latin America in a nutshell. Basically, yeah, because here in Latin America, the people generally expect one populist hero alone to change the situation, but they never seem to learn, right? I mean, my feeling is that the lack of education is one key aspect for history to keep repeating itself around here. So I wish you all the best to Colombia, you know, and I hope things keep improving, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. It was tough in the 80s, 90s, but I think things can be more favorable to the country now, and let's hope for that. So I know you like cycling very much. Tell me more about that.
Well, Anand, I think cycling is just like, of course, it's a passion, but you know, it has so many things that are connected to art. But basically, you have to have a lot of discipline. You have to climb the mountains. You have to suffer. You have to have some failures, like when they reject your papers as well. But then you have to keep pedaling until you get home and enjoy, you know, what you have achieved. And I think that's a nice thing. You have also hours of solitude, so your mind is just revolving, and you are having some thoughts while you cycle for hours. So it has a lot of things that bring me a lot of joy, and it's part of my life. So I try to balance what I do professionally with this other aspect, which I truly enjoy as well.
How often do you cycle per week?
Pretty much every single day, except one day when I rest, just after the weekend. But I try to cycle every single day.
Wow.
I try to train, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I visited Colombia in 2012, as I said in the beginning, during the Olympic Games. And I remember the excitement of the people when one Colombian cyclist won the silver medal. It was a very nice experience to witness that.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think we have been having so many good cyclists in lately, and you mentioned Rigoberto Urán, that's his name, and yeah, he's a national hero, and we have many others who have followed his steps, and I think it's a very exciting activity here in Colombia. Of course, we are also fortunate of the topography, you know, as I said, mm-hmm. we have a lot of mountains, so you can find climbs of 80 kilometers, so that you go from sea level to 3,500 meters. Mm-hmm. So that makes you, you know, probably the setting is the right one to get involved.
Yeah, so you have a large variety of local optima.
That's true.
Yeah. So any special reason for choosing industrial engineering as an undergrad degree?
Well, Anand, when I think about that, of course I really liked in high school math and physics, so I was leaning towards more the engineering side of things, and then let me just tell you, you mentioned soccer, you mentioned cycling, and I have just one sibling, she's my sister, and she was playing with different things, so I had to make up my own games. I love to play with marbles, and I was coming up with these games related with soccer and with cycling, and I was collecting a lot of statistics and data, and I was making, you know, my games, and then I was just writing down a lot of numbers. So I really enjoyed doing some, you know, collecting data, analyzing the data, trying to make some forecasts of what it was going to happen. So I think that was my connection. So I said I need to choose something that has to do with this data analysis, and then probably that was my right choice, and I'm mm-hmm. I'm happy I chose that. Mm-hmm.
Did you have OR classes?
Yes, and I think that was the turning point, because when I was in college, I went to Universidad Javeriana, which is a Catholic university, and that university has an emphasis on manufacturing, as many industrial engineering programs do, and manufacturing was excellent. So I was enjoying my courses in those topics. But when I got my linear programming course, taught by Carlos Lopez, that's the name of the instructor, everything changed in my life. It was like I was seeing the light for the first time. So I realized that there was this tool that you were able to solve pretty much every single problem in the world with this modeling technique and software that you can solve for these variables that you were posing. Mm-hmm. So I was just amazed for the variety of problems that you could solve. And I think that course had something that was really fantastic. And this instructor gave us a weekly homework where we had to read some news from the paper, from the newspaper, and come up with a problem that was handled by linear programs. So basically we were reading some news, posing a problem, and approaching the solution of that problem, which was fantastic. It was forcing you to see possible applications of linear programming everywhere. And mm-hmm. I think that was amazing.
Right.
And that was for me, it was a course that changed my life.
Mm-hmm. And what was your first OR project?
Okay. I think the first serious project that I had was in my capstone project. And I did it with my friend Gabriel Pardo, and he was my buddy in the university, and he was really good with programming databases and so on. So we just made a team, and we approached the people from the university hospital, and we tried to solve the diet problem, the famous classic diet problem, but trying to cope with some aspects for the human diets. And we were meeting with the nutritionists and coming up with this solution. And it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And also, thanks to that, trying to solve that problem, I had some contact with the people from SAS. So to solve the problem, we had access to SAS software. The vendor of SAS provided us with a license, and we solved the diet problem with their software.
Mm-hmm. So did you go to the industry after obtaining your undergrad degree, or you went straight to the master's?
Anand, because I had this relationship with the SAS vendor, so they offered me the opportunity to work with them so that I can promote the use of these tools that were not as commonly used as the statistical packages from SAS. So I worked for them for about 7 months until the master's program in industrial engineering opened at Los Andes, and I was attracted to that program. So I said, okay, let's move and go for this master's. And mm-hmm. that's the story.
Mm-hmm. And what was your master's project about?
Okay, so in the master's, the nice thing of the master's was that it was like one of the first programs in the country that offered a strong OR and a statistics emphasis. So one of the faculty was Gonzalo Torres, and Gonzalo Torres was also working for a shipping company, maritime shipping company. And they were having this problem of moving containers all over the world, and there was this imbalance of containers, empty containers and full containers and so on. So he posed us this problem, and I solved it with my friend Edgar Blanco, who later went to for his PhD in Georgia Tech. But we were tackling this problem, and it became a really nice project because the idea was to develop a software for the company and handling this large mixed integer program mm-hmm. that we formulated. So mm-hmm. again, we use SAS for solving the mixed integer program. But the nice thing was that I started to put on these challenges of having better models, you know, to tackle mm-hmm. this problem. And also there were many things in the software that we didn't fully understand and make me curious about, okay, there is a whole world on these optimization problems that probably I have to conduct probably a PhD to understand all these magic that is happening behind the software.
Yeah, I understand the feeling. But how was the OR situation in Colombia at that time during the 90s?
Okay, so I would say that the nice thing was that other programs around the country started to offer at the master's level. So it was fine, but there was not a very strong society in terms of an organized society. There were very few people with PhD degrees in OR, and they were involved in these master's programs, and that was the beginning. But it was only until the 2000, early 2000, when an entrepreneur, an OR entrepreneur, Jesus Velázquez, he formed this OR society, the New OR Society in Colombia, and it was good at the beginning, you know, but then not too many people got involved, and then in a second phase later on, the community from Medellin, the academic community from Medellin, they took the leadership with Juan Villegas, and then with the support of Alio, as a matter of fact, from Luciana Buriol and many of the good people in Alio, they help us to form this new OR society. So basically, the community, as I said before, it was a bit more in the 90s, a bit scattered, and only after the year 2000, and it became more of a society, mm-hmm. of an OR society.
Right. You were mentioning about that necessity of doing a PhD to try to learn the details behind the algorithms and, you know, the optimization algorithms. How did you get a PhD position in the US?
Okay, so just before when I was finishing my master's, I had like this opportunity of getting some support from Los Andes, to, because that was part of the culture at that time, and many universities, because they didn't have faculty with PhD degrees, they were also investing in young faculty to get their degrees abroad, and I was fortunate that I worked for them during my master's like a TA, a teaching assistant, and then I got some support from the university at the beginning, and I chose North Carolina because I was at that time, she was my fiance, my wife, she's a medical doctor, so she needed also some space in terms of public health, medical or medicine programs. So at that time, the perfect fit was North Carolina. So we chose, okay, let's go to North Carolina. There were other aspects like SAS, the headquarters were in North Carolina. So I said, oh, probably I have some opportunity because I have some skills with that language. So probably that could also help. And I think at the end it helped.
Mm-hmm. So everything fit into place after all. Yeah, that was nice. And how about the coursework and qualification exam? Everything went smooth.
Yes, Anand, I think it went smooth. It was it is a really nice program. I think the founder was Salah El Magrabi, and he was still there when I was there, and they had a really good faculty, and they were really good mentors for all of us. So I have Salah El Magrabi, Dr. Fang, Jaja Fati in interior programming, Shushan Fang, who was my advisor, Jim Wilson, Steve Roberts. So many, many good faculty. The nice thing, it was an interdisciplinary program. We had faculty from statistics, mathematics, different engineering programs, and it was a wonderful program, but it was challenging as well because the PhD qualifier was made by faculty from all over the different programs. So it was like I had to take an exam in dynamic systems, also stochastic processes and so on. But it was nice. At the end, everything went well. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy I went there.
So you definitely acquired a really vast background in terms of OR, and that is really good. And what about your PhD research? What did you study?
Okay, so my advisor was Shushan Fang, And Professor Fang was very excited at that time. He made in the 90s he made contributions to interior point methods, but in the late 90s when I was there, he got interested in soft computing. Basically, it was computing with words and having more like optimization guided by expert knowledge. So something which is closely related now with artificial intelligence. Okay, so at that time, there were funds from Nortel, a semiconductor company, and also from the National Textile Center. And they supported my research on simulation optimization. It was more trying to control the inputs of a complex machinery in terms of the semiconductor industry. For example, there were some machinery that were having a lot of failures, but with expert knowledge, they were being able to get a better throughput. So the idea was to understand what was going on and trying to come up with this expert knowledge and guide the optimization of this system, trying to tweak the inputs to the right levels, like the knobs of these machines, so that we get better output. So I did at the end some simulation optimization, and it was that was part of the work that I did mm-hmm. at that time. So I got involved a lot with heuristics, like evolutionary algorithms, with neural networks as well, mm-hmm. and that was part of the things that I did.
Right. So it was essentially knowledge-based optimization through simulation and controlling the inputs, you know, I
exactly.
Yeah, nice.
Exactly, Anna. Mm-hmm.
Did you return immediately to Colombia after concluding your PhD?
No, Anna. I did a summer internship in SAS when I was studying at NC State, and it was great because I had the opportunity to go to this very strong OR group at SAS with your friend Radhika Kulkarni. With Mark Cohen and wonderful people in SAS. And this was a really nice and vibrant OR group. They were, of course, developing all these tools that were part of the SAS OR modules. But then they were, at that time, they were switching into building solutions with these tools. Because before, it was more of selling just the tools. So that was a very exciting time because we were posed with challenging problems from different customers that they had, like Walmart and other big players. And we needed to come up with solutions based on OR. Mm-hmm. And it was very challenging. And of course, the wisdom and of someone like Radhika, it's just amazing. So learning from them, from her, was a unique opportunity. So in the summer, then I connected, when I finished my PhD, I went for a postdoc and I worked also in this team, but my postdoc was related to developing a modeling language that they lacked. They had the solvers, but they didn't have a modeling language. So I got deep into programming and I developed this prototype modeling language, and that was my duty.
Nice. So you probably learned a lot of things there at SAS, and I'm glad to know that you had contact with Radhika Kulkarni, the current Informs president, and she was here as a guest. Wonderful person, and from whom you can learn quite a lot, right?
I totally agree, Anand.
Yeah. So what was the feeling of returning to Bogota?
Okay, so it was, at that time, as I said, I went with my wife and she was finishing her PhD, so I had to return first. I was called by Roberto Sarama, who was the department chair at Los Andes. And he offered me a position that it was related to, of course, to OR, but there was a change in the national science and technology system in Colombia. At that time, they were forcing or they were encouraging researchers to work in groups because we were very isolated. So he said, okay, Andres, I want you to come here and work as a faculty, but your responsibility is also to try to form this group so that we have an OR group. And that was pretty much the beginning of what I have, I lead now, which is the COPPA, the Center for Optimization and Applied Probability, which I formed with other faculty who were returning by that time. And that was very exciting. So that's why it was a big motivation for me to return.
Excellent. So Andres, your research papers are very diversified. Can you pinpoint some of your most early relevant work?
Sure, Anand. Yes, as you said, like I was returning back from the States, and part of what I needed to do was to recruit students and get students engaged with OR and with these methodologies. So and this is part of what we do here in Latin America a lot, and probably you relate with me in this aspect, is that it's not only we don't have this very mature society that everyone knows what is OR or analytics. We need to learn the smaller ones, the younger ones, that, you know, what is this all about? So we need to do teaching and we need to scout. So at the beginning, I was, when I started to do my research, I was bringing all this expertise that I had from SAS, like these modeling languages and being a bit more professional in terms of building software libraries. And the other thing that I knew was like this expertise that I had from my doctoral dissertation on these evolutionary algorithms for solving different problems. So I realized that I needed to have like some software libraries that help me recruit students to solve real problems. So one of the good aspects of Los Andes is that many companies, because they don't have a very strong R&D department, they come with their problems and they say, oh, look, we have this problem and it's related with this fleet of vehicles that we have. And then naturally it comes like, okay, you need like a vehicle routing problem software or some solution for that particular problem. So companies come with these challenges also, like transportation companies like the Transmilenio, which is the bus rapid transit system, and so on. So many of these companies approach you when you are new, you're joining the department, so they know that there is this supposedly expert in optimization or operations research. So problems come. That's very nice. But the challenge was that you needed to recruit students and to build these solutions. So at the beginning, I developed these software libraries that were more modular, that were extensible or easily extensible, so that I could engage students, they could solve these problems, they could prototype fast, because that's the other aspect. At that time, we didn't have a strong doctoral program. We only had undergraduate students and master's students. So I needed to be efficient in terms of the solutions, and when one student left, probably other could take this piece and build on top of that. And so building libraries of components was key at the beginning, and that got me involved in many different problems, especially combinatorial problems, as I said, rapid transit system problems, the bus rapid transit system problems, some vehicle routing problems, and so on. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I was also able to recruit very good students like Juan Villegas, Jorge Mendoza, who later became my first PhD students. Mm-hmm. And that completes a bit of the second part of my, or the second moment of my research, which was like all these contributions that I made in vehicle routing with these students, because we formed this joint PhD program with some French universities like the Ecole de Mines de Nantes, and the UTT, the University of Technology of Troyes, with my very good friends, Christelle Garrett and Christian Franz, which who you know very well as well. And also Michel Gendreau was involved in some of these projects later on with another student who was Victor Pillac. And this was great because basically I got into vehicle routing, working with them and using all these software libraries that I had developed with my students and putting them in good use with these ideas of Christelle and Christian and Michelle. And especially one very important idea at that time, and you are an expert in vehicle routing, so you know what I'm going to talk, is that at that time, Christian had made this contribution or had revisited this idea of the route first, cluster second paradigm, using and proposing this split procedure.
Yeah, you have a giant nice door and you have to do just split, yeah?
Totally. So that was new at that time, the proposal of a split. So most of these PhD students that I had at the time got involved in vehicle routing with this split paradigm, and we were extending it to different routing problems like the truck and trailer routing problem, multi-compartment, stochastic multi-compartment routing problems as well, with the technician routing with Victor Pillac later on. So what we shared in terms of methodology was trying to expand this split idea into different domains. And that also got me involved with looking to these underlying structures, like these shortest paths that got to be resolved in the split mechanism. Mm-hmm. So that's the other part that got my attention. And of course, as you know, and you also do in Brazil with your group, one view is the meta heuristic or math heuristic that it's of course you have this framework of a meta heuristic, but then you have some math programming behind it within the heuristic procedure, like the split procedure, that it's supported in network optimization, and that was one part. And the other part was trying to approach the problem from a more exact way. Mm-hmm. So trying to make column-oriented formulations more towards column generation. So I think that was part of the work that I did with them at that time.
Right, yeah. I'm familiar with some of the work you mentioned, like the truck and trailer VRP and some of them. But one thing that caught my attention is the work you're describing have little connection with what you've done during your PhD. So you kind of had to reinvent yourself. Like you said, your mom reinvented herself to adjust to the situation at that time. So maybe you're doing that to be able to survive academically, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, Anand, I think that's a good point. But I was fortunate that, you know, the program at NC State was really good in terms, as you mentioned it before, it was very broad in terms of the techniques that we had to learn during those school years. And one of the best courses that I took, I had two courses that I really, really loved, many courses, but let me just point a couple of them. One course was large-scale linear programming, which was taught by my advisor, and it was great. So I learned all these, some of the composition techniques and semi-infinite programming and many things that were really exciting for me, and that I got like a good fundamentals on those aspects. And a second course that I really loved was integer programming by Yahya Fathi, and I was always excited about this integer programming. As you mentioned, I was tackling these in my master's, these MEEP. So with Professor Fathi, he unveiled all this wisdom behind these branch and bound and cutting planes and so on. So it was very exciting, but I didn't have to do my research in on those aspects, as I mentioned. It was more towards simulation optimization, but I got like these ideas and these good courses. So when I worked in these vehicle routing problems, it was very natural for me to embrace back these techniques, mm-hmm. and trying to learn them back and get a bit deeper on these aspects. And the other person who was very influential for me at that point was Michel Gendreau and Dominique Feillette, mm. who by this time I got to know them, and it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. So they were responsible of engaging me in this new era for me. That was very exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the whole people from HEC in Montreal and Polytechnique in Montreal, you know, I know that you have very close connections with them, and that's one of the best places in the world to get involved in this.
Yeah, absolutely.
In these techniques.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about techniques and ways of solving problems efficiently. So in terms of methodological contributions of your own, mm-hmm. which ones do you consider the most important?
Anand, I think, you know, after that time when I was got involved in routing and I was diving into these underlying shortest paths, I was fortunate to have like a very good student at Los Andes, Leo Lozano. He's now faculty in Cincinnati, and later on with Daniel Duque, who works in Google, in Google Labs, and a series of students. Now, lately, Daniel Jamin and Daniel Barahona and Nicolas Cabrera at HEC Montreal.
Yeah, you have great alumni.
Yeah, these really good students, and especially at the beginning, Leo Lozano, we worked together on this idea of solving different variants of shortest paths that we were encountering in these vehicle routing problems and different settings. So the idea was really amazing, because we were having this problem that we needed to solve for this bus rapid transit system application, and then we needed to solve this constrained shortest path, and at that time we were approaching the problem with more a branch and bound technique, and trying to try different techniques that were common at the time. But then in one of these meetings, we said, let's go back and see this problem from another perspective. And the nice thing was that we said, okay, let's handle this problem like as it comes, like a combinatorial optimization problem. And we just said, okay, let's see that what we want to do is we want to find these paths, and we want to traverse this network. And we came up with this idea that, okay, let's try to do this recursive exploration of the network, almost like a brute force. Of course, that's nice, because you can explore every single path, but of course it's not very efficient. So we added to this recursive exploration of the network these pruning strategies, which basically try to avoid the exploration if the path is not going to lead anywhere in terms of visibility or a better bound. So we start to approach this problem, as I said, more naturally, not just with this framework or setting that it was more common at the time. And that was like a fresh perspective. Of course, it's very closely related with branch and bound, but it was interesting that this very same framework was we were able to apply it to different problems. So at the beginning the constrained shortest path, but then later on we were able to extend it to some robust shortest path problems and other variants, orienteering problems, and so on. So I think that's probably the contribution that I think I could say
stands out
until this point. It stands out because it's a very general a framework that could be applied to many other problems.
So yeah, you were referring to the PULSE framework. Yeah,
the PULSE framework. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
It's important to mention. Yeah.
So sometimes I, this recursive exploration, we just coined that, okay, this is like sending pulses through the network. So basically, we just said, okay, this is the pulse algorithm. So we coined it like that. Uh-huh. But just to be clear, it's this recursive exploration of paths within a network. But thank you, Anand. That's what I should say at the beginning, the pulse framework.
Yeah, no.
And seriously, Anand, this has been very exciting in the last 10 years because many good students have gotten excited with this idea, and I had the opportunity to have very brilliant students, as I mentioned, Leo, and then Daniel Duque, Manuel Bolívar, Nico Cabrera, now at HSC, mm-hmm. Daniel Yamin, who's the one who has inherited everything right now, and he's extending it to stochastic domains. So it has been very exciting.
Nice. So Andres, there are plenty of opportunities to make societal impact using OR here in Latin America. But despite our efforts, I have a feeling that something is missing for the area to thrive around here. I know companies are becoming increasingly aware of the importance of using analytics and optimization, but how to persuade governments and local authorities of the relevance of using mathematical tools for decision-making when it comes to public administration?
Anand, I think you just raised a very important point. I think we have one of the most exciting things in the region is that we have a combination of things that are really interesting. First, a lot of problems that we need to solve. We still need to solve many problems in our region. And I would say I could extend this to the global south, which is most of the world. So basically we have a lot of unsolved problems in our societies. So these problems are related to agriculture, for example, in this new era in Colombia, there are a lot of opportunities, but we need to tackle these problems. And these problems are really complex, as you know. They involve a lot of data coming from satellites, weather data, soil data, you know, uncertainty, because nothing is certain in that world. We have a lot of small farmers. That's our reality, small farmers. They cannot negotiate with big players. So basically we need to make them work together. So there are collaborative things to do in these agri chains. So basically it's so complex, the problems that we have. But the OR tools are the right ones, in my opinion, to solve these really complex problems. But we need to engage the public policymakers, and we need to have different spaces where we, of course, we know the methodologies, we know the details of coming up with a model, with a solution technique. But what we are missing is that we need to get involved with them in different forums that are not just OR forums. They are in different levels. We need to communicate with them, and we need to engage with them, and we need to co-create with them. And I think that's an important thing that sometimes we miss in our field, is that we are so excited, as we have been in this podcast talking about different techniques, but sometimes we miss that, you know, these real problems, others are facing these real problems, and they are not knowledgeable of OR, but that's not their problem. It's our problem that we need to find the right way to communicate with them and to engage them and to show them how powerful these tools are. And we need to send this word by engaging them and participating in forums that are not necessarily OR related. And I think that's part of the critical things that we need to do. So we need to do this transdisciplinary research. It's great that we work with our students, but we need to go and show others that our tools are so powerful that they embrace them and they use them. And I think that's something that we need to do, definitely. We have a lot of exciting problems in our region, but we need to do that. And we have another ingredient that it's great. We have passion, and students are passionate about solving problems. So that's another key aspect. That it's like a fortune. We have a lot of good and exciting minds trying to get involved in these topics, and we have problems that are coming, but we need to make this bridge. And for that reason, sometimes, Anand, in our context, we believe, okay, methodological contributions are very important, and of course they are, but you know, problems come from practice. See? And I think that's those are the roots of OAR. And I think it's nice because that also gets students excited to be part of the mm-hmm. solutions.
Yeah, yeah,
to
for sure.
Part of the solutions. Yeah.
We have to definitely improve our communication skills, you know, marketing skills. Sometimes we are really paper oriented, and we try to do everything nice and improve the results of benchmark instances to get the approval of our peers. You know how it works. But maybe some way of valuing the practical work. You know, when you can do something that is not that fancy in terms of methodology, but it makes a lot of impact and it creates mm-hmm. Opportunities. And maybe those that are evaluating, you know, the programs, you know, graduate programs or even the researchers themselves, I think they should also look, especially here in Latin America, I think they might mm-hmm. also turn attention to the actual impact that you were doing as a scholar overall, right?
I totally agree with you, Anand. And there is another aspect, Anand, that is very important in our context, and probably it's not that important in other latitudes. But for us, it's not only making research, just as you said, very rigorous research method in terms of methodologies, which are great if we do that. It's absolutely fantastic, but the other thing is that you mentioned a bit or in this conversation that how is the setting in our country or in the 90s and so on, and we are young. We're still a young society in terms of OAR, so we need to come up with more people to get engaged in this domain, and the way to do that is by creating capacity in our countries, and that's done by teaching students, and for us it's quite important. For you know, it's sometimes I feel and I reflect on this when I talk to some colleagues in other parts of the world, and they see students sometimes as a burden, like say, okay, I have to teach undergrads and I have to teach this linear programming course, or but you know, it's like a burden, or even a master's degree course, and for us it's not like that. We need to get very excited in every single lecture that we do, because we need to scout the best students, the best minds, and we need to get them or make them very excited about what we do, mm-hmm. because they don't have many reference points in their families to know
yes.
what is a PhD,
yeah.
what is OR. So we need to recruit them, and that's very important. We need to bring them close, and we need to make them work with others, and this is quite important to have this oral tradition, because we don't have many people, so we need to form like a brotherhood.
Yeah,
probably
exactly.
You have, yeah. I know that you understand what I'm saying, but probably you have your PhD students, the PhD students have other younger students who like master students who work with them, and then the master students have, or the TAs have some younger undergrad students who we need to recruit them very early so that they can taste
yes.
and savor what yeah. research is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what we have to do here in Latin America.
Yeah.
It's not just like, I want to work with just PhDs and postdocs, because there are not enough. It's we need to form them.
Yeah.
And that's the other key part of what we do,
yeah.
is building this capacity.
I understand completely. That's why I recruit students at a very young age, when they're 17, 18, 19, because I know that the learning curve, it's really promising when they're very young. So I had a lot of success by, you know, having students engaging in OR at a very young age. So Andres, in some places in Latin America, there's an increasing pressure for researchers to produce more and more papers. In order to fulfill the requirements, some scholars attempt to maximize the score of their profile at all cost. It seems that they care more about the numbers or whatever benefits they get from reaching high scores rather than actually doing relevant work. How do you see this issue in Colombia, especially in OAR?
Anand, you raise a very important point, I think, and it's related to the level of maturity of our society in terms of having good mentors that teach us where to publish, how to publish, what is ethical or not in terms of publishing. And I think that's what I see. I see that sometimes young faculty, they are just forced to have this high throughput in terms of publications, but they just throw bullets everywhere. It's like a yes. Scattered, you know, production that it goes to different journals of different niches, and seriously, sometimes even worse because they go to predatory journals that they don't have like this very high standard of giving good feedback in terms of the referees and so on. So at the end, I'm afraid that these practices that are not good practices will make us even more unknown in terms of the contributions that we can make in OAR. And I think that's a big challenge. This is a big concern. And I think we need to address it in different forums. So probably in different OAR societies, when we have our annual meetings, we need to have these panels and address that, because sometimes I don't see people doing those things because they are bad, but they have not been guided well. And I think that's a matter of mentorship. But it's a very important thing. Sometimes, I have seen it that now that I have to evaluate younger colleagues, they just see the impact factor, and if it has a good impact factor in the top first quartile or second quartile, they mm-hmm. just go and publish there. But sometimes, you know, they are not building like a consistent
body of work,
and it's hard for them to become part of different societies, to get recognized, because they are just sending bullets everywhere in different domains. Yeah. And I think that's bad. And especially if they send those their work to unknown journals with bad reputation. Yeah. And sometimes they don't even know that. And there are other ethical considerations that are quite critical. For example, what makes you an author of a paper? Sometimes they make some decisions, and they have some authors, they bring authors in their papers because of different reasons, and that's really bad. So I think we need to address that, we need to confront that, and we do have that problem. I think that's a reality. Mm-hmm. But it's part of our society to teach younger faculty through what we normally do, oral tradition, like those good practices. Yes. And we have been fortunate to have, as a society, the Colombian OAR society, more mature societies like the Brazilian society, the people from Uruguay, from the south of the continent, the Chile, who have been very open and generous with us. And they have pointed us to some of the practices that are not that good. And I think we have learned from them, mm-hmm. and we need to do that as a cascade. We need to do that in our own societies, yeah. as well. But
things have been improving there in Colombia, I believe. So that is a good point to,
totally.
To highlight. Things still have to, of course, get adjusted. As you said, some researchers, scholars have to mature. You guys rely a lot on the younger generation to make the changes, absolutely. But we should see that I think you guys are moving forward for sure. That's a key message to convey, I believe.
Yeah. Anand, I totally agree with you, and I think that's a whole message. And I think, as I said, when you asked me about my life in the country. I think if I see now things and I reflect over 50 years, I see an improved country with a lot of problems, of course, but it's a better country. We have a better quality of life in general. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with our society. We do have problems. We do have, of course, problems that you have addressed. But I think we have improved a lot, and we have better production. We have more impact on in the society. We have so many problems to solve, as I said, uh-huh. in transportation, in pollution. Our cities are demand from us many things, and that's very exciting. It's not that we have problems. We do have problems, but we have a lot of opportunities to act and to engage, as you said, in some points with policymakers to make them aware of the tools that we know, what we can provide to society as a whole. And I think that's a very exciting thing. So I think we have a vibrant group of young generation of war research operations researchers that are coming on board, exciting about solving new problems, many of those problems related with sustainability. So basically we are on the right track, Anand. Mm. I should say that.
Right, Andres, thank you so much for your time. It was a great pleasure to talk to you. Muchas gracias. It was fantastic.
Anand, thank you very much for the invitation. And I think it has been a pleasure talking to you, to a friend. And it has been a very exciting time.
Yeah. So, Andres, mi amigo, no te olvides de visitar João Pessoa. Don't forget to visit João Pessoa when you're coming to Brazil. We'll be very happy to host you here.
Well, I just have really good memories from Brazil. So I just want to go back because, first of all, I admire you a lot, like all the work that you are doing with many of the top researchers that you have in Brazil. But the most important thing, Anand, and this is something that I got very excited, is that with time, I think the most important lesson that I have learned is that you have to work with people that you enjoy working with. And definitely that's the attitude of the Brazilian people. And you just have fun with them. So, of course, I look forward going back and working with you.
Absolutely, me too. So, Andres, ha sido un placer. Muchas gracias once again. Thank you so much, and I hope to see you soon. Ciao. Bye. Hasta luego.
Adiós.